Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. We thank all of you for joining us tonight. If you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3 to begin that process. At some point, hopefully within the next week, we will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website. If you'd like to access that file, or if you'd like to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at www.house.gov/Capuano. If you do have a question for Congressman Capuano tonight, please press star 3. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano, who would like to make a few opening remarks. Congressman, whenever you're ready.
Thanks, Allison. First of all, I'd like to welcome everybody who's joined us tonight for a discussion. I hope that everyone who's listening in will find it informative and somewhat entertaining and enjoyable. There is no particular topic that I have in mind to discuss. It's the best way I have to be able to try to stay in touch with as many constituents as I can. This week, Congress is out of session. Most of us are back in our districts trying to catch up on the things that we can't do while we're in Washington with meetings and events. And for me, I'm out there a lot listening to constituents, trying to find out what's making their world more difficult. And that's pretty obviously still the economy, and we all know that. We continue to work on it. We passed some laws just last week, some bills relative to some mortgage fixes. Trying to make it easier. I'm sure most people who are listening heard about the bill that we passed to try to deal with some of the credit card abuses by the companies that issue those cards. When we go back, we're probably going to focus on a couple of things, at least in the financial services end of it, most notably relative to some sort of regulation for the entire industry, trying to figure out what the right balance is and how to get it done, how to address the modern financial services world as opposed to the one of the 1950s that we really tried to address for the last 40 years. It's time to catch up. And with that, I think I'm going to stop, and my hope is that some people have already called in with some questions. I think it's always more informative and more enjoyable to answer questions than it is to try to give a lecture. So I'm hoping that some people have already called in with some questions, and if they have, I'd be happy to try to answer them as best I can.
And if you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question this evening, remember, just press star 3 to begin that process. And we'll take our first call tonight from Barbara from Chelsea, who has a question about cell phones. Barbara, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Oh, thank you. Good evening, Congressman Capuano.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
As in New York, they banned people using cell phones and texting while they're driving, and I want to know what's taking Massachusetts so long to get this passed.
Well, I mean, it's probably won't be done by the federal government. If anything gets done, it'll probably be done by the state government. And my understanding is that the Commonwealth, at least one of the branches, has passed a new bill relative to texting. I'm not sure about the cell phone use. I have my concerns about that as it is. Certainly, I don't think you'll find anyone who thinks it's a smart idea or a good idea to allow people to text while driving, and I fully expect that Massachusetts will ban it as well.
Okay, we now have Dave from Chelsea, who has a question about bankruptcy and auto dealers. Dave, when you're ready.
I'm ready.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, David.
Hi, Congressman. Dave Presley.
How are you?
You know me. We've met.
Yeah, hey, David. How you doing?
Not too bad. Look, we spent big bucks on Chrysler and General Motors. We did not on Ford. Of the three of them, General Motors and Chrysler are going bankrupt, and employment is going down. Doesn't this tell us that spending money on these big corporations is not a good idea?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Ford didn't take money because they didn't need the money. They're still in relatively decent shape. I think it's always a fair question. This is not an easy question to answer because it's a judgmental thing. The question is always, is doing something more difficult or more less beneficial than doing nothing? And that's a fair question that we each have to make our own judgment when we're faced with it. In this situation, I fall on the other side, David. I think that we cannot simply sit by and watch millions of our fellow Americans lose their jobs and to lose the auto industry altogether. I'm not happy about this. This is not the kind of thing I wanted to do when I ran for Congress. I don't think it's a good policy in the long run for the federal government to be bailing out private companies. At the same time, in this particular case, looking at the options, watching Chrysler and GM and go bankrupt and not come out of bankruptcy, that's, again, it's judgmental, but I believe most people thought that would be true. I just didn't think that it was in the best interest of the United States of America. Now, that's somebody who doesn't, we don't have any auto manufacturing going on in Massachusetts. We do have some auto parts suppliers that would lose jobs. The last I heard, there was like 40,000 jobs in Massachusetts that are directly related to it. And we wouldn't lose them all, but we would lose some of them. And so it wasn't a parochial vote for me. This was an issue that, you know, like anything else, when there were hurricanes in Louisiana, we send help. When there are natural disasters in California, we send help. And in this particular case, it's not about Michigan. It's not about it's not a parochial interest. It's about what's best in the long term for America. And in this case, and again, maybe I'm wrong. We'll find out over the long run. But I thought it was important for us to maintain as many of these good jobs that are all mostly middle class jobs in America for Americans, and to continue the ability to build and manufacture automobiles. Again, I don't know if it'll work out. I hope so. I think so. We will find out in the long run.
Okay, we now have Claudette from Brighton, who has a question about college financial aid. Claudette, when you're ready.
Yeah, I guess I'm ready. Hi. As I was in pause, I thought of all kinds of other things, like, you know, how my pension, or how I have no pension, how I have no retirement. But let's go with my initial question, and that is, I have a child who's starting her second year of a six-year college program, Mass College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and we got no financial aid except for school loans. And if the tuition bill was around $30,000 in school loans, they say that they're like 7 or 8 or 9% interest, but then I find out it's not regulated anymore, and that's over prime. That's ridiculous. That's like something that, and she's taking it out, and I'm co-signing it. We're never going to get out from under this. Multiply that by 6 years. And did we get any like scholarship? Well, she didn't get, did she get any like free financial, any kind of thing like that? Like they have like extra money that they can give to students coming in based on the finances of the parents. And I would be deserving of this kind of thing because I'm a single mom, but because I have paid all my bills on time and all my credit card bills on time, it turns out that I have managed to have a very good credit rating, and because of that, they said that I could, in theory, get a loan, and so I would not be getting any, like, discount.
Doesn't sound right. I mean, I'm not arguing.
No, but that's what they say. It's punitive. You pay your bills on time. Okay, you can go take out a loan. Oh, we've got these people here who have a kid, and they have a lousy credit rating. Okay, they can have this, like, financial aid. We're not talking about loan. That's what they told me. This is what they told me.
I don't know who you're talking to. I would encourage you to call my office tomorrow. Maybe we can put you in a different track. I was just sitting here just the other day going over the college loans with my children, trying to figure out how to pay them back. Now, they're both out of school, and they're on the other end of the college loan issue. So this is not an issue that's unfamiliar to me. And what you're telling me, I don't know your specific situation, but it does not sound right to me. My children qualify for loans, and we pay all our loans. I don't know what my credit score is, but it's pretty good. I don't know who you're talking to, but I would really strongly encourage you to call the office tomorrow, and we'll try to get you on a different track. It may not work. Maybe there's some anomaly about your specific case. At the same time, I want to answer a more general question. We struggle a lot in Washington trying to get more kids college aid because obviously there's a lot of kids. Most of us believe that this country would be better off with a better educated population. We believe that kids should be going to college and should be reasonably affordable. At the same time, with all the number of children that are in the schools, it costs a fortune. We can't make it free because the American public is not willing to pay that degree of taxes. So what we try to do is in the last couple of years, we've significantly increased student aid. We are currently in the process of probably ending the concept of private student aid. It will probably be a direct government program again. It was a direct program at one time, and then mostly the Republicans thought that the government can't do anything right, so let's give it to private companies. And the private companies did it, and they're the ones who drove it up to the 7 to 9%. It was never that rate. And I don't know where it's 7 to 9% now. It's usually most of the loans are lower than that. But anyway, So we have done a fair amount with college loans. I don't know that we'll ever be able to do enough, but we will struggle to continue to do that. And as far as your specific situation, Claudia, I really would encourage you to call the office tomorrow, and we'll see if we can walk through some more specific details.
Okay, now we have Emily from East Boston, who has a question about...
Te vuelvo a llamar en como dos minutos, okay? Yeah. Hello?
Emily, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Oh, hi. The reason I'm calling from East Boston. Thank you very much for having this forum. I appreciate it. I'm calling because I am really in favor of single-payer health care, and I know that you have supported H.R. 676 in the past, and I think you may have signed on to it again. And
yep.
I'd love to see this become a reality because, first of all, I don't like the Commonwealth of Massachusetts telling me I have to pay for private insurance, which I have to do now because I'm a part-time worker. So it really only privileges people who either have no work at all or full-time, whereas single-payer I feel like would be the cheapest way to get the most people covered. I mean, and so I'm wondering to what extent you'd be willing to really be a champion in addition to signing on, really being loud for it so that, you know. Go ahead. Yeah.
I agree with you, Emily. I mean, I have to give it a caveat. I'm pushing it as best I can, but this is, first of all, not a new issue. So most members of Congress are familiar with the issue. They already have an opinion on the matter. Not all, but most. And we were at, I don't know, the last time I checked, I think we were at about 100 of the 435 members who supported the bill, but I'm not sure they got my numbers right. But anyway, so I am supportive. We're going to do what we can. But at the same time, I want to be clear. I am not going to vote against a bill that is not perfect, in my opinion. If I can do anything to, I don't know, improve the health care of a million Americans, for the sake of discussion, even if it's not perfect, I am not going to let those million Americans go unserved. And I know that some people would. You didn't say that, but others, I have had that told me by some people, that shouldn't vote for any bill unless it's exactly what you want. And I'm sorry, I think that's an unapproach. And on this particular issue, I'm not convinced. I'm pretty sure we do not have the votes for it. We'll continue to fight. We're going to have a major battle on health care this year. I think everybody understands that. And that's a good thing. If we can get single payer, we will try. There are many of us who support it. If we can't, we will try to do our best to get as close to it as we can. And hopefully that will improve the situation for as many people as possible.
Okay, we now have Russell from Jamaica Plain who has a question about the Patriot Act. Russell.
Hi, Congressman. My question is about the Patriot Act. I was wondering if there has been any momentum around after several years of the Patriot Act and sort of seeing the infringement on personal privacy across the country, if there's been any momentum behind repealing the Patriot Act now that there is such a, I would say, broad majority in Congress.
I wish you were right, Russell. I voted against the Patriot Act. I voted against every amendment to it that we've had. I actually think it's probably the worst thing. About the Patriot Act, you've given me an idea, Russell. I will at least file a bill to repeal it because I agree with you. But I'm going to be honest. I don't think I'll have much success at it. But nonetheless, it's important to do. And we have amended it a couple of times. I even voted against those amendments because I just didn't think it was the right thing to do to try to make a very, very bad bill even the slightest bit better. And so for me. I stand 150% with you, Russell. I will do everything I can to get rid of it, but I can't lie, and I do not believe that there's a majority will even in America. I don't think that the average person thinks about this issue, and I would love it if more people would, because I think if they do, they'll realize that the civil freedoms have been taken away from them by this act, and they have not been made any safer by it.
For those of you who are just joining us, if you do have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3 to begin that process. And we now have Helen from Jamaica Plain who has a question about the Waxman-Markey climate change bill. Helen, whenever you're ready.
Oh, yes. Hi, Representative, and thank you for doing this forum. This is a terrific forum, and I made a suggestion also just in addition to my question that to appeal to the younger people, you might want to think about doing some online blog kind of thing for the younger people.
Yeah, but if I do that, I lose the seniors.
Yeah, well, I'm over 50, but, you know, I sort of walk in both worlds, so I can...
Yeah, I know.
This was a good forum, and that would be a good forum, too. I guess my question is the level of your support for the Waxman-Markey Energy Security so-called bill, what is it, 2454, and where that is right now, and if you do support it, what can we do to encourage its passage? I'm particularly concerned about the acceleration of global climate change that's been documented very well by the International Panel on Climate Change, and also the fact that it does sponsor, in many respects, green jobs, jobs that cannot go overseas, and I don't think a lot of people miss that point.
Helen, the bill has already been significantly amended just coming out of committee. The way the process works is a bill is proposed, it goes through a committee system, the committee makes a recommendation to the floor, it gets to the floor, there is a potential for additional amendments, then it goes to the Senate, and there are more amendments. And the bill that you're speaking about has already been significantly amended just to get it through committee. We do not have, well, we might have now, but we did not have on that original draft the 218 votes that we need to get it through the House. It's hard to tell until a vote actually takes place, but it's pretty widely believed that there won't be very many Republican votes for it, and that we all know that there are many Democrats who are hesitant to vote for it as well. And not so much them. And here's the problem, Helen. It's always the problem with bills like this, even Patriot Act, things like that. I wish I could give you a good answer as to what you should do, but the problem is that the good thing and the bad thing is that the entire Massachusetts delegation is going to support this bill, and we're going to fight. We already are fighting for the strongest bill we can get. Obviously, this is the Waxman-Markey bill. Ed Markey, our own colleague from Massachusetts, is the lead sponsor of this bill. He's fighting very hard for it. All of us are trying to help him with it. At the same time, we're not 218. We're 10. We have to get to 218, and right now I know for a fact it has eaten, drank, and slept this bill for months now. And, we're doing things like we have to make deals. And some of these deals all these deals have one by one weakened the bill a little bit in my estimation. I still think the bill is at the point where it's worthy of support, and I hope it will be that way, it will continue to be that way through the process, but it's still too early to tell. So I have no good suggestions as to what you should do to make sure the bill passes. I can only tell you that the entire delegation is doing its best to try to get the strongest possible bill through the House and then through the Senate. But I would ask, and I'm asking everybody. I had a meeting today on it with some people over in Jamaica Plain, and I've had several other meetings on it. I'm asking everybody who cares about this bill to please keep an eye on it and to let my office know your estimation as to whether the bill continues to maintain the level of support that it starts out with. Because in the political process, it is always about taking less than you want, and it's never about getting everything you want. The bill that was drafted, the one that you mentioned, the Waxman-Markey bill, was the bill that we wanted. And now, one by one, we have to take one item away, one item away, one item away, and it's a judgmental call as to when have we given too much away. I don't think we have yet. But I do think there's a risk, and I do not want to participate in passing a bill that we feel good about, but is really just a fig leaf. We're not there yet. At least I don't think we are. But nonetheless, the best way that I'll have a real good, strong opinion on that matter, and the best knowledge I can get, is by getting as many people like you to keep me informed as to how you read it.
We now have Bob from Chelsea, who has a question about stimulus funds. Bob, whenever you're ready.
Good evening, Congressman. This is Bob Bolris.
Hey,
Bob. I'm the treasurer for the city of Chelsea, you may know.
Yep, I do.
And I have an interest in knowing what was all the recent cuts in local aid and the anticipation of state local aid cuts, what you might be able to do to assure that the greatest proportion as possible of federal stimulus money gets down to the local level.
Well, in the stimulus bill that we passed, the bill that passed the House, and I should know the numbers off the top of my head. I don't. I'm sorry. sorry, but we had a huge amount of money that went to the states and the cities and towns directly for general revenue. Well, that was exactly the kind of money you're talking about, the kind of money to maintain budgets as they are. I just don't remember how much we passed. It went to the Senate, and I don't know if you had a chance to follow the system. This is pretty public. When it went to the Senate, we did not have the votes to get it done. They had to sit down and make a deal with so-called moderate Republicans, including two from Maine. And those moderate Republicans, the very first thing they did is they cut that bunch of money in half, so that the amount of money that just came through on local aid, and mostly school aid, and also came through to the state for them to maintain their budgets, billions of dollars, is the result of having it cut in half. And, again, like anything else, we could not get it through the Senate. Everybody knew it, and we had to accept half a loaf. I don't know if we'll be able to get back to the table and get the rest of the loaf, number one. And number two, even then, that's still only one-year money. That's the kind of money that you can't really rely on, but it does ease the pain for a little while and gives people a little bit more opportunity to, number one, get out of the economic crisis we're in, and number two, make more thoughtful plans for the whole situation. So that's how it happened. I don't, at the moment, I'm not aware that we're really talking about a second stimulus bill yet. We might down the road, depending on how, you know, what happens to the economy, but it probably won't happen for several months, if it happens at all.
We'll now take a call from Kathy from East Boston, who has a question about credit cards. Kathy, when you're ready.
Hello.
Hi, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Kathy?
Hello, Kathy.
Yes, hi. I'm from East Boston. I received my bill from my credit card, and this is the first time I've come across anything like this. It says that I have the flexibility to skip a payment, and I don't quite understand how to take this, because I'm afraid that if I do skip a payment, that the next time I may have to make a double payment.
I've never heard of that.
Have you ever heard that? Yeah.
No, I haven't. I've heard all kinds of, you know, games that they play, but that's a new one to me.
I'm always afraid that they're gonna, you know, charge double interest or something. And then when I got this in the mail, it said under where you usually have to make the payment, there's two zeros, and underneath it said you have the flexibility to skip a payment.
I guess you always feel free to. And they'll hit you with interest and penalty charges. I haven't seen your bill, but I shouldn't give you advice, but that doesn't sound right to me. I think you're right to be suspicious.
All right, now we have a question from Bob from East Boston, who has a question about gas prices. Bob, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Good evening, Congressman.
Hi, Bob.
I think this is a wonderful opportunity for your constituents to get a chance to talk to you or to somebody higher up in the government. My question is, the recent increase at the gas pump, the price of oil, a barrel of oil, is down around $55, $60, yet the prices have gone up like close to 40 or 50 cents a gallon in the past week or so. If you remember 6 months ago, when barrel of oil was like $109, $110 a barrel, and the prices were sky high. The speculators stopped speculating on it, and the gas dropped, the barrel of oil, price of oil dropped, and the gas prices at the pump went down. Well, the speculators aren't back into the oil, yet the prices are starting to escalate, and I'm just wondering, what the heck is going on? Why hasn't someone spoke up about this?
The speculators never go away, Bob. They may take a rest, and they may go someplace else, but they never go away. This whole situation with gas prices is exactly what's wrong with an unregulated market. There is no law whatsoever that regulates these markets. People can do what they want. They can buy, they can sell, they can hold. And that's all well and good in the normal course of events until they start moving the price as they have done, as they did last year, and they're doing it again now. We've tried several different times to get laws passed, particularly on windfall profits. We've tried other things to try to rein in some of the speculation. Thus far, we have not succeeded. We have not succeeded very simply because, again, we don't have enough votes in Congress. We have members from Congress who come from who first of all believe that the government should have no role in any of the capital markets. I don't happen to agree with that. Then we have other members who may think they should have a role, but not in oil and gas because they come from Texas or they come from Louisiana or they come from other oil-producing states. And that all that adds up to, and then we have other things who say, well, you know, anything you do, if you put a tax on them, they won't cut the price. They'll just jack the prices up, which, of course, is not true. Bottom line is, up until now, we have failed to be able to do this, which, again, I want to go back to a previous question. I would argue that that argues strongly in favor of trying to do something on our energy resources. We need to get off of gasoline, and we need to get off of gasoline so that we won't be subject to these kinds of price spikes that are not related to actual cost. They're only related to profit, and the only way to do it, if somebody has something that you want or that you need, and that's all you can do, you have no choices, you have to go get gasoline to drive your car, you're at their mercy. And to me, the only legitimate way out, we can do some short-term things, thus far we have not, but the only legitimate way out is to get off of gasoline and to move on to fuels that do not depend on somebody who can control it. And that will take some time, but Brazil has done it, other countries have done it, and I think America should do it, and there's no doubt in my mind we can do it. It's simply a matter of will.
We now have Julie from Boston who has a question about funding for violence prevention. Julie, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hi, yes. I appreciate being included in this conversation. I am concerned about the increase in shootings in the Boston area and other urban areas in Massachusetts. They aren't all fatal shootings, but most often involve young people. And my understanding is that some of the limited prevention programs are at risk for being cut. And I know some of those are not federally funded, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what we can do about that and also about just gun control in general, given the increase in public shootings in schools and other public locations in recent months.
Well, gun control in Washington will never happen. I shouldn't say never, but it's not going to happen in a long time. The NRA, for reasons that are beyond my comprehension, pretty much controls Congress. They get pretty much anything they want. I'm obviously not one of their supporters, but so be it. So if any gun control is going to have to happen on a state or a local level, probably a state level. Massachusetts has pretty good laws about that. Nonetheless, the other part of it, I'm a former mayor, and as a former mayor, I will tell you that, violence prevention programs work. And the other thing that works, that we're coming into the summer, we're going to have a lot of young people out on the street with no jobs. And I think that it's a very dangerous situation. On top of the typical crime that happens in urban areas, that's going to add fuel to the fire. And I think that, again, here we are with some short-sighted problems. We have an economic problem, and things do have to be cut. But until people realize that sometimes government spending is the only way around these things, we have to give these kids some summer jobs. They can do some productive work. We have to fund these programs that deal with these kids, because otherwise we may as well just move to the Wild West. And I, unfortunately, Julie, I think we're probably in for a difficult summer all across the country. This is not unique to Boston, but it is a national problem. And I hope I'm wrong. I want to be wrong. But I think that you're going to see general violence levels increase this summer as more and more kids get out of school and can't find work.
Now we have Esther from Jamaica Plain who has a question about jumbo mortgages. Esther, when you're ready.
Thank you, Congressman. My question is about jumbo mortgages. I own a triple decker, as do many middle-class families in this district. Would love to be able to refinance and take advantage of the lower interest rates, but any of us who bought a triple decker in the last 10 years, our mortgages are at what would be a jumbo mortgage rate, and the interest rates have not come down. My understanding is that they were supposed to, but it's never quite happened. I'm just wondering if you can shed any...
Is it not owner-occupied?
Yeah.
Is it owner-occupied?
Yes.
And the rates haven't come down because, again, just like anything else, it would depend on income levels. But if you qualify for them, you should be qualified for something significantly less than a jumbo mortgage. An owner-occupied three-family house is treated the same thing as an owner-occupied one or two. Again, without knowing, obviously, all your income levels.
No, that's very helpful. Actually, I was told by someone otherwise that that's interesting. So I will...
Yeah. I would contact your bank and contact as many other mortgage lenders as you can, and Again, without I can't answer your financial situation, obviously, but
yeah, no.
if you qualify for a normal loan, it should be significantly less, you know, lower rates than a jumbo.
Okay, now we have a question from Deborah, who would like to ask about foreclosures. Deborah, when you're ready, your
Thank
question
you.
For the Congressman.
Thank you so much, Congressman. I do appreciate being able to participate in this call, and so thank you for calling me.
And,
tied to the woman that just spoke in terms of mortgages particularly, with all that has been set down on paper to encourage mortgage companies to work with their borrowers to try to refinance restructure their loans so that they don't lose houses, primary residence, there are some lending institutions that are not even coming to the table, or that when individuals are presenting their requests, they're just being totally denied. And so, you know, how can we assure, what can we do to try to reduce the number of foreclosures that might still be very imminent? And that's my first question, and I do want to ask you to talk a little bit more about the government taking over school loans and taking them out of privatization, because it is, you know, for students who have come out of school, you know, with a $160,000 school loan making maybe $30,000 a year, you know, $160,000 is a mortgage.
It's huge.
So.
All right, Deb. We just passed a bill last week relative to foreclosures. It will not help everybody. We haven't been able to find a way to do that, but it will help a lot of people try to renegotiate their loans and to get a more equitable loan that won't get them in trouble. But I want to be clear: we'll never be able to help everybody because some people are so far in and so deep in that they're just, you know, unfortunately they're just going to get hurt. In the meantime, we're trying to help people as best we can. We've done a fair amount of work, but a lot of people have their mortgages with companies that are not regulated. I don't remember the exact statistics, but it used to be that everybody got their mortgages from banks. Banks are heavily regulated. The federal government, state government has overseen their activities for years. In the last, 5 to 10 years, most people started getting their mortgages from mortgage companies. They are totally unregulated. They don't have to answer to anyone. Now, that will change, but it's taking us some time to figure out exactly how to get that done. In the meantime, they have to answer to the people that they sold these, they sold these loans. They're not sitting on the loans. They sold these loans. And therefore, there are bondholders out there that they owe money to, and they're having a hard time negotiating with them. So therefore, if they can't negotiate with them, they can't renegotiate the loans, which is it's a catch-22. Again, part of the problem in getting a loan from an unregulated entity. What we have done is we have tried to encourage them to do it. We've made it a little bit more beneficial for them by trying to help them recoup some of their losses, but we can't force them to do it. It is still a private contract. We did try to be able to do something. I'm sure you read something about this thing. I don't like the term, but it was called this cram down, which would allow people to go into bankruptcy on their primary residence and therefore allow a bankruptcy judge to renegotiate the loan if necessary, if it was that bad. But we were not able to get that through the Senate. We got it through the House with a lot of controversy and a lot of fights. But we were not able to get it through the Senate, so therefore it's not law. We will go back at that fight again, but I don't know what's going to happen with it. So all I can tell you is that we are struggling. We have made some progress with trying to, especially a bank-owned loan or a loan that's owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Those loans have been a lot better, a lot easier to deal with. If they're owned by a private non-bank mortgage company, they're the ones that are most difficult, and I can only tell you going to keep struggling to find ways, and I believe that within a month or so, this bill that we just passed will take real effect, and you'll see some benefit, some ability to help people. Not everybody, but a lot of people. As far as the student loans go, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I never liked the idea of allowing middlemen into student loans, not because they can't be more efficient. On some levels, they can be. But because once you let that happen, just like gasoline, these are businessmen. They're in to make a profit. So therefore, they get the money from the federal government and they roll it out to private. Well, they don't get it from the federal government, but they get it at the benefit of due to the benefit of the federal government, and then they roll it out to private, and they pretty much can charge any rates they want to. I happen to agree with the president that that would be better off if the government was the one who gave direct student loans and there were no middlemen. We could cut a fair amount of the cost out of it, and we did it for years and years and years. We did it for probably 40 years that way. It worked out pretty well. When I was in college, I had a college loan that was like that, and it was, I think it was 3%, if I remember correctly. Nobody's loans are 3% today. So I think that's going to happen, but that's going forward. The kids who already have loans now, again, we're trying to help them with some of the bankruptcy laws, and again, for the kids who are so deep in. Other than that, we're trying to be able to get them to renegotiate. Most of these loans, the rates have gone down, but the nut of the loan is still there. I mean, somebody had to pay for the college education, so most of it is still principal, and if we can help with that, there's still a lot of programs for kids who get into teaching or get into public safety or get into other things. If those kids can get some direct help with their loans because they're giving back to the society. So those kinds of things will continue to be difficult. And until we ever get to a country where college education is taken as a right, which I'm not sure we're not even close to that, but until we get there, unfortunately, we're probably going to have generations of kids who are going to have to struggle through with these loans.
Now we have Tony from Mission Hill who has a question about affordable housing. Tony, when you're ready.
Hi, good evening, Congressman. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm a nurse in Boston, and I'm caring for homeless families. Right now we have over 750 families living in motels at a cost of over $1,300 per week. And my question is whether or not you see in the future any increase in monies for sustainable, affordable housing or a return, if possible, of the federal government in offering funds for affordable housing versus the state, which really hasn't done a very good job of building units.
Right. Well, I think the answer is yes, but not in the short term, Tony, because of the economic crisis. But I believe that both Congress and the White House are now run by people who understand that that there are less expensive ways to deal with the homeless population than some of the ways we deal with it now. At the same time, we do have an economic problem. We have to deal with the immediate crisis right away. And I honestly feel the state has done a decent job. Most of the state picked up a lot of the slack. Well, we had the federal government has just, in my opinion, has just changed its approach towards this. Up for the last, 10, 15 years, the federal government has thought that the whole concept of affordable housing was wrong, and they want everything they could do to cut back on any support for affordable housing, for seniors, for the homeless, for the ill, anything they could do, they did. And honestly, I spent a lot of time during the Bush administration fighting against proposed cuts. Now, we won a lot of them, but we didn't win them all, and we lost some things. And when that happened, the state stepped into the breach. And again, they couldn't replace every dollar, but I think they did a decent job during a tough time at the federal government. It wasn't a tough economic time. It was a tough philosophical time. And unfortunately, now we have a tough economic time. I think the philosophies are more in line, and I believe wholeheartedly that affordable housing will regain its rightful position in the list of priorities for this country. Again, it's going to take some time because of the economic situation, but I believe that will happen, and I think that over the next year or two or three, you will see a renewed commitment to the understanding that people deserve an affordable, decent home.
Now we have Georgia from Jamaica Plain who has a question about stimulus funds. Georgia, when you're ready.
Thank you, Congressman Capuano. Yes, due to the problems in the economy, the number of people applying for food stamps has jumped to 20,000 a month, and because there aren't enough caseworkers, they have 800 clients rather than 250. The number of people that can get on the program a month is about 10,000 rather than 20,000, and so they need to hire more caseworkers. But the Massachusetts budget, they've cut, caseworkers, and the stimulus package, and according to Jeffrey Simon, who's running it in the state, doesn't allow the state to hire caseworkers to put people on the program, and this is all federal money coming into Massachusetts. Is there anything you can do to allow Massachusetts to hire caseworkers from the stimulus package?
Well, that part of the debate really had to do with the concern of, again, I'm sure you seem to know this issue, Georgia. I'm sure you know that there are a lot of members of Congress from the rest of the country that don't really like the food stamp program. So that's part of it. The other part of it is there is always some concern that when we do this, the idea of the program is not to be able to hire everybody, but the idea of the program is to get as much assistance to people who need it. So the balance is always, well, do we put any limits on hiring or don't we? And in this particular case, the compromise, not a very good one on some levels, but it's what we had to do, was to say, okay, we'll just put it towards food stamps. Now, that's true about a lot of programs, and there have been some problems with the stimulus program. This is one of them. And if we go back to do a stimulus, if we adjust the stimulus program, or if we actually do another one, I do believe that that issue will be addressed. In the meantime, it's probably unlikely that we'll be able to undo it for now. And unfortunately, we just get to struggle through with it. But I think when everything's said and done, once the program, if we get back to the table to get the second stimulus, a second stimulus, then what will happen is we'll be able to have a history of what happened, not just in this program, but the transportation money, the health care money, the education money, the money that went to cities and towns, all this money, to try to figure out what worked, what didn't work, and what was the problem. This bill was done quickly, and rightfully so, don't get me wrong. And a lot of it was done on faith that we just, many of us just felt, look, we have to do something, we have to do something big, we have to do something fast. And a lot of deals were made to get it done that way, knowing full well that there'd be some mistakes made, and hopefully we'll have a chance to correct some of those mistakes, and this will certainly be high on my list to try to deal with.
Okay, now we have a question from Steve from Boston, who would like to ask about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Steve, when you're ready.
Thank you, and thank you, Congressman, for doing this today. I really appreciate this. Also, I had a recent visit to D.C. and stopped in your office, and I'd like to thank your interns as well, who were very helpful and very cooperative. My question is regard to ENDA, and I'm not exactly sure what status the bill is currently in and what your position may be on the bill and where you may think it may be heading.
My position is very supportive. For people who don't know, ENDA is a bill that will, again, allow people to be employed and keep their job on the basis of their abilities and nothing else. Non-discrimination is just what it says. I'm sorry, Steve, I can't answer the question off the top of my head. I don't know where it is technically. We've been focused so much on the economy and other big issues that demand immediate attention that a lot of issues have kind of fallen off my radar. This is one that I don't have an answer for you directly off the top of my head. If you call the office tomorrow, we'd be happy to catch up on it. At the same time, I do want to be clear. Every year this comes up, we have problems with it, and we have problems with it because there are still a lot of members of Congress who are not terribly concerned about discrimination. At the same time, it is something that is we will continue to bring this up until we get this act passed. And I'm sorry I can't answer your question directly, Steve, but again, if you call the office tomorrow, we'll be glad to find out exactly where it is.
And now we have Liz from Brighton who wants to ask a question about pensions. Liz, when you're ready.
Hello, Congressman.
Hi, Liz.
I'm curious about the windfall bill that affects Massachusetts teachers and teachers in other states, prevents them from collecting Social Security that they've paid into when they have, a Massachusetts pension.
Right.
Do you think there's any chance that that bill might finally be rescinded this year?
I don't think so. And I want to be clear, this doesn't just affect teachers. It affects any city or state employee in Massachusetts, and I think there's like 10 other states. I'm not sure the exact number, but something like that. And I happen to be one of them. I'm a former city employee that paid into the pension system for years. I'm now paying in Social Security. When my time comes, I'm going to get hurt as well. I think this law that was passed, I think it was in the 80s, if I remember correctly, this law that was passed, which I never knew about until I became a member of Congress, but I've found it a lot since then, to me is the most unfair bill I can imagine. For those people listening who don't know this issue, nor should you necessarily, unless you're personally affected, what happened is that people who might have had, most people have two or three jobs during their lives now. Very few people have one job and that's it. And so somebody who worked in the state or the city system, a teacher, a firefighter, a policeman, whoever it might be, and then, retired, or maybe before they became that job, they had a private job and they paid into the Social Security system. You'd think that when you're doing two jobs, paying over your lifetime and paying into retirement systems, Social Security in one case, in the other case, the state retirement system, that you'd be entitled to collect your due. Unfortunately, the federal government got in trouble 20 or 30 years ago. They came up with this scheme, in my opinion, to try to balance their own books. And what they did is they basically said, well, if you do that, then we're going to offset your Social Security money by some degree of money that you're getting from the state. Totally unfair. At the same time, there's only a handful of states that are affected by it. Massachusetts is one of them. And it has been every year we have this argument, and it has been an uphill battle. I'm hoping that when the economy recovers, again, it's going to be very tough to do because it will cost the Social Security system some money to make this right. But again, not, it's money that they shouldn't have in the first place. But when the economy recovers, I'm hoping to be able to do something with it. I don't know if we can do it now, because right now we have too many other pressures on demands for the dollar. But when we get back, and I'm not so sure we can do it all, and I don't think we'll be able to do it retroactively. I don't think, because the amounts of money is just staggering because it's been going on for so long. But if we can do it and do whatever we can do, especially if we can do it prospectively, I can only tell you that there are many of us who find this issue to be very important, and we're going to keep pushing on it.
Okay, now we have Jim from Cambridge who has a question about the FAA bill. Jim, when you're ready.
Yes, good evening, Congressman. I tried to ask this question last week, but couldn't get through. My issue is right now is the Federal Aviation Reauthorization Act of 2009, what it means for the city in terms of noise reduction, and also we were wondering why there was no limit put on the amount of time that a person has to stay inside the plane on the tarmac. I guess that would be my
right,
question.
Because we couldn't come up with a compromise as to what would the appropriate length of time. And what there hasn't been very many of these situations lately, because the airlines understand very well, for the most part, that won't be tolerated. And there've been mostly a bunch of good programs that people get told now. They get told mostly the truth, not entirely, and that there are certain limits that allow people off the plane after a certain period of time. They have to have food, they have to have water. At the same time, that happens very infrequently, and I travel every single week in airplanes, and I get delayed on occasion. And I will tell you that in the last year or so, between the airlines coming up with their own policies, now that, again, those policies were kind of imposed on them, they're kind of forced to come up with them, and the FAA doing a little bit better job, and most importantly, them trying to keep Congress off their back, if you want the truth, I think things have gotten a little bit better. This authorization bill does have some provisions in there. They don't have the strongest provisions that I would like to see, but it does have some provisions in there to protect the average traveler. And I think this bill will pass. I think it'll pass very soon through the Senate.
Okay, it looks like we have time for just one more question. And for those of you who are waiting and did not get an opportunity to ask Congressman Capuano a question, you will be able to leave a message at the conclusion of this call. And we'll take our last call from Susan, who has a question about school funding issues. Susan, when you're ready.
Hi, Congressman. Good evening.
Hi, Susan.
So I work in Boston Public Schools, and my question is about funding, maybe about our economy. We've been talking about keeping jobs and having the economy do better, and everybody talks about the kids being the future and the wealth of our country, but it seems that with the economy, the kids are the last one to get the funding. Working in the schools every day, I just see all the money leaving, lots of colleagues being laid off, and kids not being educated. Any ideas about what?
Well, I can tell you that, again, this goes back to an earlier question we had relative to some of the stimulus money. I believe the Commonwealth of Massachusetts got over $1 billion for local schools, and that money has been given out. The problem, it's not a problem, but the political problem, not the governmental one, is that when jobs are saved, most people never know it because people don't get layoff notices that they would have otherwise gotten. But I will tell you, without that $1 billion of stimulus, there'd be a lot more people losing their job. And that $1 billion, as I said, was cut in half. It was when it passed the House, it was over $2 billion coming just to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And we lost that in the Senate. We had to cut it in half, so we ended up with the money we have. as far as everything else goes, each city and town has to prioritize on its own. And, again, I'm a former mayor, former city councilor, and I will tell you that it is never easy to balance a city budget when there's tough times. And, you know, there's everybody has, pretty much everybody has a pretty good claim on it. You want to educate kids, but you want safe streets, you want a decent fire department, you want your streets swept. It's a very difficult balance, which is why people like me fought as hard as we could to increase as best we could to get the largest amount of money we could get through to simply give it to the cities and towns across the country so that they wouldn't have to lay off teachers and firefighters and cops, and also to let them make their own decisions, because I don't think those decisions are best made in Washington. I think that they're always better made in the cities and towns, because different cities have different priorities. Some cities will prioritize education, other cities will prioritize DPW, I don't know. And I think that the people in those cities are the ones who are best located, best positioned to be able to tell whether the priorities were appropriate or not. Not sure that we're still on, but
we are.
Okay.
We lost you for just a second.
Okay, technology.
Well, with that, I think we need to end the call. We are running out of time, and we do apologize if we did not get to your question, but you will have an opportunity to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano at the conclusion of the teleforum, and I know the congressman has a few closing remarks you'd like to make.
Yeah, first of all, I want to repeat, for those of you who didn't get a chance to ask a question, I would encourage you to leave a voicemail, and we will get you as soon as we can tomorrow or the day after. And anyone who wants to sign up for the newsletter, please go to the website and feel free. The newsletter will keep you informed as to what's going on in Washington each week. And other than that, I just want to thank everybody for participating. I hope it was educational and enlightening. It always tries to. It's one way. It's the best way I know for me to stay in touch with as many people as I possibly can, and to keep my feet on the ground. So I want to thank everybody for listening in tonight. And with that, I'll simply say good night and thank you.